This March marks 4 years since the World Health Organization first declared COVID-19 a pandemic. Now, in many ways, the world has moved on, but the threat is still very real for immunocompromised people. I'm Sasha Ann Simons, and this is Reset. In the early days of lockdown, health experts still weren't sure how the new virus spread or how dangerous it could be. And it quickly became dangerous to not take precautions. And earlier this month, the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention ended 5-day quarantines for people who test positive for COVID-19. The changes to precautionary measures make daily life especially hard for immunocompromised people who are at heightened risk if they get COVID. So we wanted to talk to Chicagoans and experts to hear how they're reflecting on the past 4 years and all the changes in policy. I sat down with Stephen Thrasher, a journalism professor at Northwestern University and author of The Viral Underclass, The Human Toll When Inequality and Disease Collide. And Megan Doherty, co-leader of Care Not COVID, an advocacy group pushing for safer healthcare settings. And I start by asking them to reflect on the current moment. Here's Professor Thrasher.
It's extremely sad because there's still hundreds of people dying every day in the United States and unknown numbers dying around the world. Obviously, now we have vaccination. We have some tools that we can use, but we've been lulled into a false sense of complacency on a lot of fronts. And as someone who's also a historian of AIDS, I think about how many precautions are still in effect for the HIV/AIDS pandemic, which still exists 40-some years after it was first discovered and 30 years after there have been medications, but we still take lots of precautions around it. But we're not taking many precautions around COVID-19, and that's why hundreds of people a day, thousands of people a week are still dying in the United States.
In your reflections, Megan, I mean, do you see that there have been any helpful changes, or are you seeing more missed opportunities? Talk us through that.
Those helpful tools that I know the government likes to tout have largely been taken away from us in many respects. They took away the free vaccinations. They took away the free testing, free access to treatments. And certainly something that's a crucial layer of defense here is good N95 respirators. And that's something they never really even provided to people. So there are folks who maybe can't afford a good respirator or access to any sort of mask at all. So I see a lot of missed opportunities. And what I'm seeing as someone who is disabled and immunocompromised is how this is a civil rights issue, how disabled folks have been de facto segregated out of public life, and how most people are not really willing to grapple with the fact that what we're dealing with right now is eugenics.
To that end, there's this phrase that we hear all the time, post-pandemic. So, Megan, I wonder how you feel when you hear people talk about COVID as if it's in past tense.
That feels like large-scale gaslighting to me. Like Stephen said, we still have 1,000 Americans dying every single week. You know, what I just heard is the CDC saying that they're estimating one in every 15 Americans has long COVID. And right here in Illinois, it's over 6% of all adults in the state have long COVID right now. So we're not post anything.
What's behind the social shift, Professor, for people to stop things like masking or just wanting to put COVID in the past?
There's a real collective desire for amnesia because what happened was so painful to us. We lost more than 1 million people here in the United States alone. And so I think a lot of people want to move past that without moving through the process of grief itself, which is very difficult. COVID forced us to really think about and sit with how interconnected we are to one another. And we've gone through situations like this in the past with public health, particularly here in Chicago. I just had company from out of town last weekend. I took them on the boat tour. They always talk about how we shifted the direction of the water to deal with cholera. Cholera was greatly making people sick and killing people, and it was something that had to be dealt with collectively. And as your other guest was also saying, air is something that we all share. It's a collective responsibility. So in addition to the mask, it's really shocking to me that we haven't dealt with cleaning air through ventilation. And there's such a desire, I think, to just put this horrible experience behind us that people are wanting to erase any visual representation of it or any practical representation of it. So I'm hearing stories all the time, not just of people stopping wearing masks in sort of civilian situations or in places where they were new, but in neonatal units, in construction sites, in places where people have long used masks, they're stopping, no longer using them. And as I always talk about with my students in AIDS history, so many Americans don't know that your doctor and your dentist and healthcare workers didn't wear rubber gloves or latex gloves before the 1980s, which were used to prevent at first a mysterious cause, eventually known to be the HIV virus, but that created broad health effects across a wide variety of benefits doing that process that we still use. Yeah, healthcare workers all still use gloves.
Yeah.
And so I thought that would at least be a new floor for ventilation and for mask use and whatnot, at least in healthcare settings. And what we're seeing is this really rapid snap back to just try not to think about what's happening, to erase any visual motif. And a lot of that's economic driven because we had like new economic tools like paid time off that were helpful for all kinds of sicknesses.
What policy changes do you want to see, Megan?
Oh, gosh. Well, like I said before, we should be going back to providing all of these tools for free to people. I absolutely agree. We need like a Clean Indoor Air Act. We need to be working on national standards for indoor ventilation and filtration. Mm-hmm. And for public essential services like healthcare settings, especially, we need to go back to the protection of universal masking.
You co-lead a group that's trying to get better masking policies into healthcare settings. So talk more about that, Megan, and what motivates you to do this work?
Yeah, so Care Not COVID Chicago started up formally almost a year ago. And we are a local group of grassroots advocates all volunteering our time to try to get our public health institutions and our healthcare facilities across Illinois to do the right thing. Healthcare settings are where we should be protected the most, rather than where we are forcibly exposed to something that might kill us. Mm-hmm. And masks are a crucial part of a layered approach to airborne infection control. This would protect not only patients, but also our frontline healthcare workers who are already in short supply. And not only would it protect us from COVID, but it would protect us from other airborne infectious diseases as well. So fundamentally, we feel that healthcare settings shouldn't get to opt out of life-saving infection control.
Sticking with you for a moment here, Megan, I'm curious how you think people can be more aware of how their choices can affect others.
I think it's important to go back to the idea of how we cannot individual responsibility our way out of, you know, an airborne pandemic where risk is transmissible from person to person. I would say that it's important to reflect on the fact that our government and public health leaders have effectively repositioned what is an urgent collective societal responsibility as merely a matter of personal preference. So this is downplaying the ongoing pandemic and pretending it's over, and also telling the public at large that you should be okay with disabled people being segregated out of public life, harmed and killed for the sake of convenience and profit. And also, we really need to do a massive public education campaign about the fact that everyone is vulnerable to long COVID. I don't think people fully understand that they cannot perfectly control their exposure risk. And also, they can't have perfect control over what their health outcomes are going to be. A lot of it is chance. I think a lot of folks are under the mistaken impression that if they're young, you know, they go jogging, they do yoga, they drink that green smoothie or take certain supplements, that if they get COVID, you know, they've had their vaccinations and they'll be fine. But there are so many people who were, you know, quote unquote, young and healthy. They got all their vaccines, but COVID still devastated them and their health has been irreparably damaged as a result. You know, people have a really hard time of letting go of this illusion of control over one's own health.
You feel like immunocompromised people are having to sort of really bear the brunt of the burden of all these measures?
Yeah, absolutely. You know, they tell us, well, if you feel uncomfortable with the risk, you can just mask yourself. But one-way masking really doesn't work because people who are especially vulnerable, like you said, they have to 100% bear all the responsibility of keeping themselves safe, and something that should be a collective effort, especially with what my advocacy group is focusing on healthcare settings, when masks are optional, you know, people with disabilities and other marginalized people may not feel comfortable or safe asking their doctor to put a mask on. Some medical providers, unfortunately, react very poorly to that. Some still refuse to put on a mask, even if they're asked. And for those providers who do put on a mask when they're asked, it's still forcing patients to be in proximity with a lot of other unmasked people in lobbies, corridors, waiting rooms, elevators, bathrooms, et cetera. So unless patients have somehow acquired a magical ability to teleport directly from their car to the exam room, then the directive to just say, oh, just ask your doctor to mask, is completely illogical and ineffective.
Let's listen to some other voices here. We heard from immunocompromised people from across the Chicagoland area.
I'm Johanna. I'm calling from Irving Park. I have long COVID. I've had long COVID for 2 years. You just kind of hope other people will be compassionate and empathize and try to step outside of their own experience and not just look, you know, towards moving on, but being compassionate for what could happen to them or people that they love and care about.
My name is Bridget, and I'm currently living in the western suburbs because my childhood home in Chicago is no longer safe for me to live in because of COVID denialism. Reflecting from where I was 4 years ago, I do want to say I have so much hope because of the COVID cautious community. We are making huge changes. I've seen so many new mask blocks starting in cities across the country. I get so many messages on social media asking how to get involved in the community and how they can start their own COVID-aware organizations. We are growing and we are connecting, and that is so incredibly powerful.
Hi, my name is Rhiannon, and I'm from Westridge. People have the capacity and can care about COVID and COVID precautions because they were able to in 2020, right? But folks just want to pretend like it doesn't exist anymore. People like me, you know, compromised folks, we don't get to forget.
Professor, you were listening along to my conversation there with Megan. I mean, if some of these policies that we're talking about aren't coming from the government, how do we create better community care?
There are ways that when we're gathering together in activism, and you see this a lot around COVID, but also activism around Gaza and Black Lives Matter and all kinds of things where people are collectively doing what they can in community. But at a certain level, things have to come through government. I mean, I recently learned how to become a phlebotomist and draw blood. And you don't, like, your patients don't have to ask you to put on gloves when you're drawing their blood. It's a standard part of what you do to keep the person doing it and the patient safe. And so at a governmental level, we do need to have standards around ventilation or masking and or, what, you know, when there are situations where there isn't ventilation. Megan also brought up, it would be great if you could teleport in. And a lot of people have had a lifeline across a variety of barriers of using telehealth over the past few years. That's being taken away governmentally. That's no longer going to be covered through Medicaid. And that was an option that not only helped people remain safe through this pandemic,
yeah,
but opened up so much more access. And so there are all these governmental levers that have been used that could have created a new floor for our times that are not being used. Mm. And I would say, zooming out at the governmental level, what I write about in my book is there are these vectors that create a viral underclass that go beyond the immediate things that we might see here, particularly homelessness, incarceration, and border policies. And all of those things, the government has been going in the wrong direction the past few years, spending far more money on wars abroad, policing, Biden telling people, telling cities, spend your CARES money or COVID money on cops instead of on things like ventilation. Those things are taking away and making worse some of the layers or lack of layers that could be slowing down transmission. And there's only so much work we can do around that in community. But at a certain level, we need governmental intervention and regulations to help clean air, clean services, clean water.
So leave us with this, and I'd love to hear from you both. We're 4 years into this, right? As we've discussed, what's the future looking like? Where do we go from here? You first, Megan.
I don't know what the future looks like right now, other than the way that the government and our public health institutions are handling this is going to prolong the COVID-19 pandemic far longer than perhaps it needs to be. I am seeing a lot of what you said, you know, community care springing up all around the world, people banding together to try to crowdsource air filters. But like Stephen said, we cannot do the work that the government is supposed to do for us.
Last word to you, Professor.
I look back to the summer of 2020, and I wrote about that in the update of my book recently, that we felt so close to liberation on so many fronts. Tens of millions of people coming out around Black Lives Matter, that really overlapping with demands for justice around COVID and disability. And I look back to where we were just a couple years ago and how much possibility we felt. And I hope people can tap into that and revive that sense of possibility, because news media and politics are really trying to make us forget that. And the American people saw it and nearly touched it and nearly achieved it. And I think that we can tap back into that feeling and keep trying to find liberation on the fronts we had in the summer of 2020.
We've been speaking with Northwestern professor Stephen Thrasher, who's author of The Viral Underclass, The Human Toll When Inequality and Disease Collide. And also Megan Doherty, who's co-leader of Care Not COVID, an advocacy group pushing for safer healthcare settings. Thank you both so much.
Thank you very much.
Take care. This episode of the Reset Podcast was produced by Max Lubbers, edited by Maha Ahmed, and mixed by Brenda Ruiz. If you like this conversation, please consider leaving us a rating and subscribing. It helps listeners like you find our show. I'm Sasha Ann Simons. Thank you for listening. You can catch us on the show today at noon on 91.5 FM, WBEZ.